I woke up in the middle of the night last night at like 12:30. Couldn't get back to sleep. It's been happening a lot lately. If any of you is a doctor or knows insomnia or something like this and wants to give me some insight, I'll take it. But lying there, trying to figure out why I couldn't go back to sleep, reminded me of a talk we had the other week over at Ascension Holy Trinity Church down the street. This was the talk, if you remember, that Jerry Springer moderated. Some of you were there. You all heard about it, probably. We were asked the question, what keeps you up at night? What keeps you up at night? What is it that wakes you up at 12:30 in the morning and won't let you go back to sleep? Have you ever asked yourself that? That was the question we were asked. And so think about it. If this was you, what keeps you up at night? What is it? What keeps you up at night? What we didn't hear a lot about, and this was surprising to me, we didn't hear a lot about money. Money didn't seem to keep most people up at night. All right, we didn't hear much about climate change. We didn't hear about health issues. Though these things, I have to admit, they kind of worry me a little bit. And so I might have been thinking about them. They may be what's keeping me up at night. But what we heard a lot about were these big social issues, like LGBTQ rights and how that's all going to play out, and the increased racial tensions across the nation, and these poisonous political scene that we hear about in the news. This was what we heard a lot about. And at the top of the list, and really I think this is sort of the core of all the others, at the top of the list was the threat of violence. Rabbi Sanford from the Valley Temple told us stories of how there were members in his congregation that had stopped coming to synagogue. They had stopped coming because they were literally afraid to walk in the door. They were afraid. Every time the temple meets now, every time they meet right across the street here in Wyoming, there's a police officer from the Wyoming Police Department there. We saw the car and the police officer parked outside this week on Tuesday when we had the Thanksgiving community service there. It's a part of the norm now. But it wasn't just members of our synagogue who said that they were afraid of all this increased violence in our world. Parents really across the board seemed fearful that their children would be harmed, would be shot, in school even. Sadly, we know that's not unimaginable today. But what has stayed with me the most from that conversation was something that the mom who was there, it was a story that he told. He said that he would regularly find himself driving up and down I-75, and he'd find this car that would sort of zoom up beside him. And he'd look over at the driver of the car, and this happened multiple times, and the driver of the car would be flipping him off, giving him the finger. The only way anybody could have known that he was Muslim was that he was in his clerical garb. These are the sorts of things that were keeping us and our neighbors up at night. These sorts of things. For me, it's these sorts of things that are why I'm here. They're these sorts of things that make me do what I do, because I've got to believe that there's something better. Right? We've got to believe that. We've got to believe it. There's got to be some sort of answer to all this fear and all this violence and all this anger that we've discovered in our world. The Jews in Isaiah's time were struggling with the same thing. The threat of violence and the threat of war were very real to them. The Assyrian Empire, this massive empire in the Middle East at the time, had this brutal war machine and this well-known policy that when they would take over other peoples, they would enslave them and deport most of them back to the main portion of Assyria. They basically numbed them to what was going on. They were numbed. And so The empire was right on the doorstep of Jerusalem and Judea at the beginning of Isaiah. This is what the context is here. And the picture we get of life on the inside of Jerusalem and Judea wasn't much better than what they were looking out on the outside. So hear the words of Isaiah chapter 1. If you're using the Pew Bible, and you can find this right in the back of your pews, it's on page 548, page 548. The book of Isaiah begins as if it's being spoken by God himself, but I want you to try to imagine the mindset of those Jews who would be hearing and then repeating these words. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, aliens devour your land. It is desolate and overthrown by foreigners. And daughter Zion, that's the city of Jerusalem, daughter Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a shelter in a cucumber field, a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. We would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah, completely and utterly wiped off the map. Wiped off the map. Advent, the season we begin today, is a season for hope. But Isaiah is trying to remind us that what's the point of hope if we can't stand and look reality right in the face? I remember taking a hiking trip out to Big Bend National Park, which is this huge park out in the boonies, the real boonies of West Texas. And so you're 70 miles away from the gate of the park when you leave the closest town. There's nothing out there. It's literally darkness, just darkness. So I understood this story about this kid who went into the woods, into this cabin in the woods with his parents for a vacation. I understood what he said. I knew what he was talking about. It was so dark. So dark that one night after his parents had turned off the lights, he calls out from them from his own room. And he goes, Mommy, Daddy. And they come into the room. They come into the room and he tells them, it's so dark. It's like, I think it's literally darker with my eyes open than it is with them shut. It's literally darker with my eyes open than it is with them shut. He wanted to see if they could find him a nightlight. And honestly, I don't blame him, because sometimes life is darker with our eyes wide open. Isaiah knew this. That's why he begins the way he does in chapter 1, with this good, hard look at the stark reality around him. That's chapter 1, but chapter 2 begins a bit differently. In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised up above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it, and many people shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations, and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. This passage has some of my favorite images in the entire Bible in it. The house of God, we hear, isn't just built on top of a mountain. It is a mountain, and it's raised up itself. It's raised up higher and higher above all the other mountains around it. Talk about a beacon on a hill, right? Talk about a light to the nations. This right here is it, Isaiah is saying. And then we get streams of people flowing not down the mountain, but up it. The actual word is for streams, like streams of water. Isaiah is using this image of streams flowing against gravity, or maybe better, towards a different source, a different center of gravity altogether. Right? The world is so changed that gravity itself is reversed. So strong is the pull of this light of God. It reminds me of a way St. Augustine in the 5th century once talked about his own conversion to Christianity. He had been wandering about from sort of philosophical ideology to philosophical ideology, trying to figure out which to him made the most intellectual sense. And then he stumbles upon Christianity because one of his favorite philosophers, he finds out, is a Christian. And this just boggles his mind until he starts to feel the pull. Augustine was one of these highbrow academic intellectual types, but when he talks about why he converted to Christianity, the reason he says is not because it made a whole bunch of reasonable sense. The reason he said was because God was drawing him to it. He was being pulled towards it. Being pulled. He was drawn. That's the picture of the nation streaming up the mountainside to God. Augustine said, "You have made us for yourself, O God, and our hearts are restless until we rest in you." The goodness of God is drawing everybody in. That's the picture Isaiah brings. Another part of the beauty of this passage, I think, is that it doesn't talk about dissolving our differences in this blessed uniformity. I think we often miss this point when we read the Bible, but it's critical that we don't miss it. You see, the mountain of God here is described as a single place, and God is said to be the one and only God. But what we don't find is any hint that our different, our cultural shapes, or our unique colors that make us who we are going to be washed away. Instead, we hear that all nations shall stream up to God. And even though God will judge between the nations and teach us all how to live without violence and coercion and war, our individual identities, they're never erased. It's the same thing we find at the end of the book of Revelation, where you get this picture that so many people have seen as this great understanding of heaven, and yet not everybody lives within this big city of God. Its gates are said to be always open, and all the nations, all the peoples, stream into it, looking for the teaching and the healing of God. Revelation says that we will come from the outside the city gates to worship at the throne of God. And that's just as important a picture of the great Christian hope as salvation itself. We aren't saved by being recast in the exact same mold as everyone else. We're saved by God healing us, healing the divisions that have shaped between us by showing us how the very differences that make us who we are can actually shine even more brightly when we're together, even more brightly, like a prism of color. So the picture we get here in Isaiah 2 is one of unity, not this sort of like whitewashed uniformity. I also love this passage, just how far-reaching it tells us about the love and the grace of God. No nation, it seems, is barred from the flow of God's wisdom and teaching. Everyone is here. We're all learning at the feet of God. For out of Zion, the text says, goes forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. To whom? To everyone. To all the nations. To many peoples. This week I got asked one of the hardest questions that I will probably ever have to try to answer. It was coming from a family who had just lost a child. And they asked, "Is this person saved? Are they saved now that they're gone? How can we know?" I think there's only one way we can honestly answer a question like that, and that's by admitting that we don't know. It's a question we can't really answer, at least not with certainty. These things are best left in the hands of God. But what we can do is we can point to passages like Isaiah 2. And we can say that we've got this really good picture of how God acts in the world. This really good picture. His love and his grace, we're told, are for all the nations. Every single last one. And if for the nations, why not the individuals that make them up? This is why at funerals, the most important thing that we can do is remind folks and remind ourselves what the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8, that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. That's Advent hope. Of course, at the end of the passage, we come to find out that all of this is accomplished by some of the most radical words in the entire Bible. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they study violence anymore. Everything we just read so far in Isaiah 2 has been about going up to God's mountain or his wisdom flowing down to us so that we can learn from him. What? This peace. This peace. We're supposed to learn peace. Isaiah doesn't say holiness. He doesn't say righteousness. He doesn't say good manners. He doesn't say right forms of worship. He doesn't use any of these words, and it's not because they're not in his vocabulary. You see, throughout the book of Isaiah and throughout the prophets in the Old Testament, what we hear God saying is that he's tired of all the empty worship, all the empty sacrifices that the people are doing, that we're doing. And instead, what he wants is peace. Peace. Wash yourselves, he says in chapter 1. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do them. Learn then to do good. Seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. Seek peace. Isaiah is telling us that our hope for a better future, our hope for salvation, isn't just waiting with anticipation. It's about acting in accordance with that hope. That's why we're told that we will learn how to take our swords and hammer them in the plowshares. That will make our instruments of death and violence into tools for life and growth and peace. In a couple of months, we're going to be able to do exactly that. Exactly that. On February 8th, two guys, one a guy named Shay Claiborne. Shane is a preacher from the South that spends most of his time now in Philadelphia, and a blacksmith named Mike Martin. Shane and Mike are going to be coming to Cincinnati. A number of the churches right here in Wyoming and this area are inviting them in to it's hard to even call it a program, it's a ministry. It's a physical living into our hope. So they bring this little forge, and they work with local law enforcement and the FBI, the police. They work with local families who have suffered violence of whatever kind, and they will take, whether it's guns or knives, and they'll take them and they'll put them in the forge, and they will literally, in front of you, turn them into garden tools. Real, physical, metal garden tools. It's not just some, like, shady political event or something like this. They invite the families who have suffered through the violence to come in, and in the midst of hammering this gun that might have shot their son or daughter or their parent or themselves, they hammer it, and out pours into this hope. Hope for a better future. Hope for a better tomorrow. They act it out in the midst. And this hope is healing. This hope is healing. So this Advent and Christmas season, we can't just hope with anticipation for the coming of Jesus. We have to remember that this hope is moving us to action. This hope is moving us towards that mountain of God that we stream up to and learn from him how to bring peace. Peace. That's what we hope for. In the midst of our fears, in the midst of the things that keep us up at night, we remember that God's not done yet. That God's not done yet. And so we look forward to not just his first coming, but his second, when finally that mountain rises up and all nations will come together and learn peace. Amen.